Welcome to MediaPath. I'm Louise Palenker.
And I'm Fritz Coleman.
Today on the show, we will look deep and gongingly into the eyes of The Gong Show. If you fan hard for all things gong, this is your jam. If you walked out of your way around any television displaying The Gong Show, this episode will broaden your awareness and understanding behind gong culture, those who worked behind the scenes, and contestants who, in great loving detail, fondly remember their 3 minutes of gong fame. Joining us are the author of Gong This Book, Adam Neidiff, and former NBC and Chuck Barris adjacent staffer Shelley Herman. First, Fritz.
Yay.
What do you reckon?
I'm going to talk about an Apple streamer today called Palm Royale.
Right.
It's a comedy. It's a drama. All you have to know about it is it stars Kristen Wiig. It's life in and around Palm Beach's most exclusive fictional resort called Palm Royale. It's set in 1969. Maxine Delacorte Simmons, played by Kristen Wiig, is trying desperately to negotiate her way into Palm Beach society. All she wants to do is to be accepted by the rich, entitled society women, and will do just about anything to make that happen. Traveling in the circle can be fashionable and catty and treacherous and hilarious. It's based on a 2018 novel called Mr. and Mrs. American Pie by Juliet McDonald. The 10-part series is rich with co-stars like Allison Janney, Ricky Martin, Laura Dern and her father Bruce Dern, Josh Lucas, Julia Duffy, and a weird but wonderful part played by Carol Burnett. Carol plays the family matriarch, Norma Delacorte. She has very few lines. She spends most of her time grunting and looking mystified because she drifts in and out of a coma. I know it sounds dark, but in Carol Burnett's hands, it's periodically hilarious. Fun surprises. It may be the first time Laura Dern has played opposite her father. I don't know that she has in the past. Maybe our guest would know. It's an interesting father-daughter dynamic, including an LSD trip. Ricky Martin, who plays Robert Diaz, Norma's caretaker, and I gotta say, turns out to be a really convincing actor. He does a good job. Allison Janney, who is obsessed with being at the top of the social pyramid at Palm Royale, excellent and edgier than most of her roles. Mindy Cohn, as you sing, oh, that's what happened to Facts of Life's Mindy Cohn. She plays Anne Holliday, one of Palm Royale's entitlement posse. But the best is Kristen. She's many things: hilarious, naive, manipulative, and cute. I really like Palm Royale. They could have called it Mar-a-Lago adjacent. But it's good. I'm enjoying it.
Well, I watched a couple of episodes and I'm waiting for Carol Burnett to wake up.
You're going to wait a long time.
Oh my gosh. Okay. So yes, but Mindy Cohn is part of my page history because I was a page on The Facts of Life. So yep. Yes, I am going to talk about something a little more serious. I'm doing, Fritz, a book-to-screen experience, as you know I love to do. This time I am doing We Were the Lucky Ones, Georgia Hunter's novel based on the true story of her family during World War II. Georgia's journey began with an English project when she was 15. That's when she first learned that her grandfather, Eddie, had escaped the Holocaust. She never even knew that he was born in Poland with the name Adi, short for Adolf, a name now resigned to the ash heap of historical villain history, along with Caligula and Attila. After college, Georgia set off on a 10-year journey to piece together her family history, which unfolds into a sweeping tale of courage, chaos, grit, stamina, ingenuity, and love in the face of human horror. The brutality of the barbaric Nazi regime spills across Europe, and the Kurtz family is flung to far corners of the globe in ghettos, camps, armies, factories, prisons, Siberia. Survival tactics included enduring beatings, forging papers, toiling to exhaustion on a scrap of bread a day, hiding babies, charming ambassadors, walking hundreds of miles, scaling mountains, all while hearing no word from family for 6 agonizing years. The 8-episode miniseries brilliantly depicts the period, the turmoil, the brutality, the desperation, and the settings from Poland to Italy to Brazil to France, Senegal, Casablanca, and the frozen tundra of Siberia. And it illustrates how love is the indistinguishable force which will pull us through our darkest times. We Were the Lucky Ones is a heroic book by Georgia Hunter in an 8-part series on Hulu. Very well done.
I saw the first episode. Okay. And what I was drawn to it by was the lead young dark-haired actor. I can't remember his
name. Logan Lerman.
Logan Lerman was on. on Jimmy Kimmel.
Okay. One night,
and he just seemed so charming, and I really loved it. I just haven't gotten around to finishing it.
Yeah, no, I'm going to highly recommend it. Mm-hmm. But first, or second, I'm going to highly recommend it, and then I'm going to introduce Adam. Okay. Adam Neidiff is enjoying a lifelong obsession with late-night comedy, afternoon cartoons, and game shows. According to his bio, he also sometimes goes outside. Adam has worked on... His line. Adam has worked on The Price is Right, Wheel of Fortune, and Double Dare. He's now a researcher for the National Archive of Game Show History, and his books, many, many books. These books include The Matchless Gene Rayburn, It's More Than Password, The Life and Wife of Alan Ludden. I think that's the greatest title of a book, like, ever. This Day in Game Show History, and most recently, Gong This Book. Joining Adam today is our friend Shelley Herman, whose book My Peacock Tale recounts her adventures as an NBC page, which included working backstage and alongside Gong Show and Gong Show staffers. So I'm going to open with this question. How do our game shows reveal our cultural sensibilities, and how does the history of game shows reflect in brand and era?
That is a great question, and Shelley, I'd like it if you could.
You know, I answered that the last time I was here. Let Adam answer it.
Let me try to peel the banana here. Break that question down, and we'll go one at a time.
Well, when you watch the game show channel and you look at Match Game 76, for example, it's like, wow, if you needed a time capsule of 1976, this would pretty much do.
Yeah, I mean, historically, game shows have tried to be contemporary and capture what's in the zeitgeist, and you see that reflected in the trivia material, and certainly on the game shows that I work on now as a question researcher, we try to go with what exists now and what exists and is current and is meaningful to people, and that changes as times change. And so you look at a game show in the 1950s, and what might have been an easy question in the 1950s is now completely impossible because it has something to do with some person or some concept that's disappeared into the dustbin of history. So there's that element of it, but also just what people are winning on game shows reflects what matters in society or what's important in society. There was a time when the big prizes on game shows were appliances and furniture because people owned homes. And as it's changed more and more to a rent-based society, you see more and more often vacations being given away or gadgets being given away because just a neat thing to have or a neat experience to have, that's what we value now more than a possession that's going to last for 20 years before you have to replace it.
But also culturally, like what's acceptable even in the concept of a game show like Queen for a Day or something, which, you know, or the sob stories.
They have a whole different meaning now.
Oh my goodness. We could revisit that.
That's a RuPaul production coming soon to a theater.
Queen for a Day is one of the most surreal shows. People, if you try to describe it to somebody who has never seen it before, they think you're making it up. Because they brought out four women and asked these four women, okay, explain in agonizing detail how bad your life is. Mm-hmm. And then the audience voted with their applause on who had the worst life, and that person got
a Westinghouse washing machine.
Well, the one that kills me is, there's an episode that I watched when I was researching a passage that I wanted to write on the shows of the 1950s. And the woman's issue was she was about to have major surgery, but she had seven children, and she didn't have the money to pay for seven caretakers for her children. So she needed some resources to take care of these seven children while she was recuperating from surgery for 3 weeks. And the prize was they gave her a kitten.
Yeah.
But couldn't they split the difference? Like, I don't think she needs a caregiver for every child. Wow. Couldn't they just have a nanny for a week?
So, and along that same line, the Gong Show broke several molds. Mm-hmm. It broke the mold of the winner always being the winner. It broke the mold of formats in game shows. And it broke the mold of the formalized, suit-wearing, salesman-like host.
Yeah.
Describe what the Gong Show was for our three listeners who weren't around when it came out.
So what the Gong Show was, it was a daily talent show. People who did all sorts of acts on the Gong Show came on to be contestants. And when I say all sorts of acts, we're talking about opera singers in bib overalls because they were, you know, he was a country singer and he could also sing opera. So you had this guy in bib overalls who came out and sang an operetta.
Was it Jim Nabors?
No, it was a gentleman named Mountain John Hilligoss.
Ah, Mountain John.
ventriloquist, woman who sang Happy Days Are Here Again, and her dentures flew out while she was singing the song. That's the kind of thing you would see on the Gong Show. You would see animal acts that didn't do anything. You would see dog acts that wouldn't cooperate with their owners. And these acts all got judged on a scale of 1 to 10 by celebrities, including, for example, Jamie Farr, J.P. Morgan, who was a singer, but I think now is best known for having been a judge on The Gong Show, Artie Johnson, formerly of Laugh-In. They would judge these acts on a scale of 1 to 10, or if the act was so bad that the judges determined that they weren't worthy of continuing, the judges had an enormous gong behind them, and they could bang that miserable gong at any old time and end the act right there. And at the end of the show, the act that had the highest score of those who had survived won the almost unusable grand prize of $516.32.
But let me back up a little bit, too, because that's not how the Gong Show started originally.
Right.
Chuck Barris wasn't the original host.
It was Gary.
Well, there were two hosts.
Before Gary. Gary Owens.
Oh, hold on. Let me push up the glasses here for the effect. Actually... So originally it was Gary Owens who had hosted the pilot. They shot a pilot in San Francisco for the Gong Show and they showed it to the networks. And one of the great stories was a network executive at ABC. ABC didn't pick up the show because one of the executives had pulled the tape of the pilot out of the machine and said, "You should be ashamed of yourself." So NBC picked up the show. NBC didn't like Gary Owens' performance. So they hired a guy named John Barber.
Mm-hmm.
And John Barber.
Real people.
Yeah. John Barber taped five episodes of the Gong Show, and in all fairness to him, the Gong Show was new, it hadn't been done before, and it was going to be a pretty different beast. So John Barber did not know how to host this show. And so they taped five episodes on that first day, and Chuck Barris, who was just there to be the producer, was growing more and more exasperated. Chuck had a staff photographer, Vince Longo, who admitted that he was taking photos of Chuck during the break because there was a vein that was becoming more and more visible with every taping break. And he was just fascinated by the way this vein was growing as the show was going on. But Chuck was trying to relay instructions to John Barber. And basically, John is trying to host it like a game show host. And I would say in the five episodes that I've screened that John hosted, kind of his defining moment was there was a contestant whose act was she blew into the crook of her arm to make music.
Oh, and I do that.
Yeah. And the panel gonged her, and John came out and said, "Well, I hope the panel's criticism is of some value to you."
Oh, my goodness. We've actually had John Barber on this show. Gary Owens is a close personal friend of ours, and I don't know a lot about John Barber's hosting because he came on the show to talk about the JFK assassination, but Gary is so uniquely, quirkily funny that I think he could have gotten into the rhythm of it, but it wouldn't have been the Gong Show that came to be. And so tell us a little bit more about the evolution of how Chuck and the show kind of blended into like one entity.
And before you do that, go back and talk about what it was to start and failed. It was like a regular talent show that tanked.
So it was a regular talent show to start off because that's what Chuck had in mind. It was going to be a Staircase to the Stars. And the initial auditions were so alarming to Chuck that he changed his mind and said, actually, we shouldn't even be doing a talent show. Let's forget this. And he had actually just binned the idea completely. And then Chris Beard, who was a guy who had done Laugh-In and had done, he had his hands in pretty much every 70s variety show.
Sonny and Cher.
Smarties Brothers.
Chris Beard suggested, well, why don't you just twist the premise and make that the point of it? Why don't you make it a showcase for bad talent? And so they had, they made an agreement to share this idea, and Chuck put the Gong Show back into production. But the key thing that caused the show to take off and to really change shape and become what it became was he did fire John Barber after that five-episode taping session. And so Chuck goes to NBC and says, listen, I've got to find another host for this because John Barber isn't getting what I want. And Chuck's vision of what the host was so specific and so narrowly defined that Madeline David, who was running NBC daytime at the time, said, you know, if you have it this precise in your head what the host of the show should be doing, you should be hosting it. Mm-hmm. And Chuck sort of brushed that off and said, no, I'll find another host. And Madeline David says, no, you're not hearing me. You have to host this show or we don't put it on the air. So Chuck pretty much with a gun to his head, had to go out there and become the host of the Gong Show. And the irony of it was this guy who did not want to be a performer, had no performing chops at all, had no aptitude for hosting a show, ended up being perfect. And he was perfect for sort of the same reason that Ed Sullivan was so perfect on his show. Ed Sullivan was this stone-faced, monotone-speaking oddball who sort of drew attention to the great talent on stage by being so not talented in his own right. He sort of heightened everything around him. Mm. Chuck was the same way. This was a showcase of mediocre to bad talent. And who better to host a showcase of mediocre to bad talent than a guy who really has no business being a performer?
Now, in your description on Amazon, you say this about The Gong Show. It's a trippy 1970s time capsule. It's a variety show. It's a showcase for new talent. It's a party. And it's a playground for its creator and star, Chuck Barris. So I don't know that any show is that many divergent things, you know, which is what makes it so fascinating to study. Like, why did all these elements go into a blender and not taste horrible?
Yeah, that's my question. It was a duplicitous type of a venture. You had bad acts, and then you brought on good acts. And did the good acts ever get gonged? It was like it was trying to be two things at once.
You know, good is in the eye of the beholder sometimes. I would say, generally speaking, the acts that got gonged deserve to be gonged. The funny thing is, for the record, on the first episode that NBC aired, the first person ever to get gonged was a 5-year-old girl because Anson Williams thought she was a bad singer.
Oh, so, yeah, can I interject with this? Even though the acts were bad and some were good, I mean, there were stars that came out of the Gong Show, it always had heart. Because Chuck really believed in these people, whether they were talented or not. He wanted them to have a moment. He wanted them to have a story they could tell their grandchildren. And in some cases, he wanted them to get a little money by being a contestant on the show.
He did so much for his staff, which we're going to get into. But let's start with the contestants, because your interviews with the contestants I found fascinating, because you interviewed a lot of staffers and they remember what they remember, but they were doing the same thing day in and day out. When you interview a contestant, that person will remember very specific details about every step of their process, who said what, exactly when, where they went. And uniformly, what they recount is how caring Chuck was about them and their journey on the show, like how he spoke to them individually.
Absolutely. And to kind of your point about Gary Owens, Chuck made the call to replace Gary Owens on the once a week nighttime show that they were running concurrently with the daytime show. Mm-hmm. And what Chuck said in his letter to Gary, letting him know that he was being let go, was, "I feel I have better chemistry with the contestants because I've gotten to know them." And what contestants told me about their experience was they were surprised by how involved Chuck was in the process, because Chuck actually was there for the auditions. So he was there at the very beginning of their process. He was there the morning of the rehearsals. Chuck ran the rehearsals for each taping of The Gong Show. And there is existing tape of Chuck running rehearsals for the show, and you see him giving instructions to the contestants and sort of buddying up to them and making them feel really, really comfortable. By the time the show has started, a lot of these people began to feel as though they were Chuck's friends. Chuck really warmed up to his contestants and took care of them. And that was something lost to a lot of the critics of the show. One thing that you heard over and over again about Chuck Barris was that he dragged people on TV to humiliate them.
That it was cruel, that it was meant to be cruel.
Which overlooks the fact that they signed up for this and they agreed to be a part of it, knowing what the show was going to be. But also, Chuck really admired his contestants for the fact that they were willing to put themselves out there, for the fact that they were willing to do something like this on national television. And he was almost, I would say, proud of his contestants for being willing to come out there and do that.
So let's talk about some examples. Let's give some examples. I have three written down. We'll start with Larry Keene.
Larry Keene was a singer from Wood County, West Virginia, which I remember because that's where I'm from, and I was surprised that a contestant was from my neck of the woods. Larry was a contestant on the show who was part of a country band. And so Larry Keene is on page 246 of this magnificent tome, Gong's
book. It is
book.
A wonderful book. I wrote down
Chuck was really taken by the guitar that Larry had, and so they were playing the guitar together during the rehearsals and also during the breaks in the audition process. He and Chuck just kind of struck up a friendship talking about guitars. And so they go on the show, and because of the way that the Gong Show was timed, you couldn't really time the show properly because if an act got gonged, that added about a minute to the show. So they had a timing issue on one show, so Larry and his band ended up being put on an episode that they weren't booked for, just because they needed to fill about 3 minutes of time. And so they got on, they won, and this woman who was there with her two children who played the bagpipes was threatening to go to the FCC or something and lodge a formal complaint.
That's what was so funny.
Yeah. And okay. So Chuck just walks up and says, I understand you have a complaint. And she made all this noise about how it wasn't fair that this band had been
She
put
had
on at
two
the last
children.
Minute.
She had bagpipe playing teenage boys. And she thinks she was robbed.
Yeah. And how dare you do this? And we're not going to stand for it. And we're going to sue. And Chuck just sort of nods his head and gives her this really serious, I'm giving this consideration look. And when she's done, he just very calmly says, get the F out of my studio. And he turns around and walks away from her. And then he picks up his guitar and says, let's jam.
And
so they just had another jam session with the band
afterwards. Where were we?
Are there any acts that he refused?
You know, my favorite stat that I learned from this, because I got a chance to talk to some of the people who were in charge of the auditions. They were called the Shock Troops. And my favorite statistic that I've ever learned in life was for every one act that made it on the Gong Show, 9 got rejected. So when you watch an episode of the Gong Show, and they usually had 7 acts per show, just keep it in the back of your head. There were 63 acts that were not as good as what you saw on that show.
And do they do it like Idol and America's Got Talent, where they went from market to market and tried to mine these
things? No, it was of all places, they held the auditions in a small condemned restaurant in downtown Los Angeles.
Perfect.
And these acts all just came in, did their thing. And what I learned was, generally speaking, the acts were good. But the problem with the Gong Show is they weren't looking for good. They were looking for interesting, memorable, stood out in a crowd. One of the Shock Troops, Vince Longo, told me 80% of the people who auditioned for the show were guys with guitars who sang. 80%. And if you can carry a tune and if you can play the guitar well, good for you. But we're not going to have guy with a guitar followed by guy with a guitar followed by guy with a guitar.
You talk about the horseshoe principle, which is like the really good... The really good and the really bad. Mm-hmm. And if you went on and didn't recognize that you were this end of the horseshoe, then someone just didn't tell you in fourth grade, you know, to just mouth the words. Or, you know, like you never, like, in, you know, at the beginning of American Idol, when they had some of that Gong Show kind of like flavor to it, you wondered how people had gotten that far in life without someone saying, you know, you're tone deaf. Yeah. I love you. You're good at this. You're good at that. But you can't sing. Like, How do you never get told? I don't know. But most people, I don't think, had their heart broken on the Gong Show. Most people knew what end of the horseshoe they were on.
Most people didn't get their heart broken. There were a few people who got Rude Awakenings and got them right on the air. One of my favorite examples, because I binge watched about 450 episodes to write this
Whoa.
Book, which I'm sure is going to make me a fascinating subject for a research paper someday. But in binge watching 450 episodes, one of my favorite things that I saw was a contestant came on stage, did a terrible performance of a song, got gonged, and she turns right around to Chuck, and this is with tape rolling, and it aired like this. She turns around and says, well, there's a problem with my microphone. They had the wrong kind of microphone. And Chuck just very calmly says, okay, let's switch microphones, and you can start your act over again. So the electrician switches out the microphones and hands her a new microphone, and they said, okay, restart the act, and they start the song over again. And then the judges gong her a second time. And then to really make it a point, they unplug the microphone after the second time they gong her and they shut the curtain.
Wow.
Now, one of the things that Adam was saying, too, was how they couldn't time the show because they didn't know when certain acts would get gonged and which acts would run the full length.
Right. So they had spillover.
And because of that, there were several stars that were born that were NBC staffers that Chuck would just throw in at the last minute because he needed to fill up time. One of them being the very beloved Gene,
the Dancing Machine. I knew him. Worked on the Tonight Show. Guy.
And I mean, it's a fascinating story because I was one of the people thrown on at the last minute also. Mm-hmm. But Gene wasn't expecting stardom. He wasn't expecting any of this, and I don't know how much to go into with Chuck with him, but he'd lost a son, and he was a stagehand, and it wasn't like a great fun job to have, and Chuck turned his life around.
Yeah. Chuck, and this is one of the things that made Chuck the world's best boss, was what people seemed to observe about him was after the Gong Show became a hit, he would sit in his office and type up scripts for these time-killing segments that they would do. Like, sometimes they would do a segment called Chucky's Fable, which was they would act out a fairy tale with different members of his staff. And it seemed like the idea here was Chuck looked for a way to get every employee of his show in front of the camera. And the extra step that Chuck took here that was really amazing was Chuck would make sure that they had union membership.
AFTRA.
Yeah. And if they didn't, he would actually pay the entry fee to get them into AFTRA, which entitled them to royalties when Chuck sold the show into reruns. So a lot of these employees of Chuck Barris got these big windfall checks when the show first went into reruns. And Chuck, to his credit, he kind of cost himself money by doing that. But Chuck would support his staff by doing that. He did that for contestants. He got his contestants' memberships into the unions, too. And so a lot of the contestants got these windfall checks. Paul Rubens, Pee Wee Herman, sort of credits his success to the Gong Show because he was a contestant on the show 14 times, which sounds insane, but Chuck Barris had made it known you can be on the show over and over again as long as you keep coming up with different things to do. So Paul Rubens managed to brainstorm enough ideas that they booked him on the Gong Show 14 times, and Paul Rubens was looking for a day job to support himself at the end of the 1970s, and suddenly Chuck sells the show into reruns, and Paul Rubens gets this big check for Gong Show rerun royalties, and he lived off that money while he was developing the Pee Wee Herman show, so we got Pee Wee Herman out of all the royalties from Gong Show.
So Pee Wee, RuPaul, Oingo Boingo, which I had on my old TV show, Phil Hartman, Robert Schimmel, Mayor Winningham.
Yep.
And what did Phil Hartman do?
Phil Hartman had the one act that I know of that he did, because the crazy thing is he's wearing latex old man makeup, so he's impossible to recognize. But he was he did an act called Pepita and Grandpa, which was him with a very attractive young woman. And as Grandpa, he recites this poem about falling in love with a prostitute. And he did fine. He survived. He didn't get gonged, but he didn't win either. And the only reason I found out it was Phil Hartman was because I was going through contestant paperwork. I had a friend who had a batch of some of the contestant paperwork from some of the old episodes, and it happened that Phil Hartman's name was listed on this thing. Without that, I'd have no idea it was him.
What about Robert Schimmel? I worked with him in stand-up, and he has a very dirty act.
Robert Schimmel was just starting to get off the ground here, and this was a funny thing. Robert Schimmel's gong show act was something that he did to impress women. I found this out from his brother. But his act was he played the piano with his nose, and he could play a melody reasonably well with his nose. And the impact that had on his career, as his brother explained it to me, was that gave him something that he could be introduced with. And that actually matters when you're an up-and-coming comic in the club. It's not just, ladies and gentlemen, our next act is somebody that you've probably seen in other open mic nights around the city. Now it's, ladies and gentlemen, you've seen our next act on the Gong Show, and people would sit up straight and go, oh. So the Gong Show gave him that kind of credibility. It's one of those things where you have to explain to the youngins who aren't familiar with that era of television the significance of being on a TV show in that era. You know, pre-social media, pre-internet, everybody had essentially three choices for entertainment if they weren't going out for the movies. And so you had access to a big audience. And here's a show that was giving you a platform for all of this undiscovered talent to make themselves known and make themselves seen around the country. And that was a door that was not open anywhere else on television. And Chuck Barris, to his credit, created that door. And the Gong Show did create stars as a result of that.
Well, the show was bawdy, and it was shocking, and it, you know, and it pushed a lot of envelopes. But Shelley, talk about the disconnect between the way Chuck often depicted women on his show and then the way that he respected them on his staff.
When I first learned about the Chuck Barris organization, I was a contestant on the Dating Game in 1972. Do the math, I'm 69 years old now. And what I saw were women in positions of having input to what Chuck was doing, and he would run things by them, and he would listen to them. And I wasn't really familiar with that dynamic in a work atmosphere before. And he promoted the women all the time. And what I also noticed about Chuck is he was very paternalistic to people. He was a hugger. He wasn't a groper. he wasn't a druggie. He wasn't into alcohol. It's not to say there weren't things going on in the parking lot in the back of the building, but Chuck was very nervous because he was controversial, and he was afraid that the feds would come knocking on the door any day now and shut him down. So he was a real straight arrow. He was a hard worker. With that said, they would also recruit talent for The Gong Show and $1.98 Beauty Pageant, another one of his shows, from some of the gentlemen's clubs so that he would have some jiggly girls on the show. He was a guy who was not only producing the show off camera, but even on camera. He was a phenomenal mind. I adored him. I credit him a lot with giving me opportunities to learn about the entertainment industry.
How close did his personality come to what was revealed in Confessions of a Dangerous Mind?
Well, are we allowed to talk about that?
His personality, I would say, his personality is close to what you see in the movie. He was more thoughtful and more serious-minded than what came across on the air.
Well, back up before the movie and the book and some of and what I guess the mystery that, that Chuck created surrounding himself so that folks who aren't familiar with Gong Show and Chuck Barris understand what you guys are referencing.
Yeah, so Chuck sort of had a mental breakdown in the early 1980s. That sounds a little harsh, but I think it's the most accurate way to put it. And Chuck wrote this book called Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, and it was presented autobiographically, but the gist of the book was he was working as a CIA hitman during the time that he was producing game shows, and he was using the game show production as a front for the work that he was doing as a CIA hitman.
As he said he would go out as a chaperone on Dating Game.
That's my favorite part. Yeah.
And so while he was traveling the world with these young people on their fabulous dream vacation, he was a hitman.
And he'd be like, look at the sunset, you guys. Bang, bang.
Yeah.
Now, and the funny thing about this is if you get a chance to see any of the Chuck Barris press tour interviews that he did when that book first came out, Chuck very, very makes it very, very clear that this is a work of fiction. And he just thought it would be neat to write this book that where he was in the CIA. And what ended up happening was I think people sort of latched onto it without having seen his book tour interviews and thought, oh, my God, did this really happen? And Chuck saw that and went, oh, people believe this. Oh, well, I'm not going to reveal if it really happened. I'm going, I'll be coy about it. So, yeah, Chuck much, much later began being coy about it. At the very beginning, he was, and I just want to say, in the 3 or 4 months that I've been promoting this book now, the big thing that I've taken away from this, if you think it's hard to tell a child that there's no Santa Claus, try telling an adult that Chuck Barris lied about being in the CIA. People get angry with me. Like, I've had some nasty comments on my Facebook page about no, he totally was. Yes, he was. You don't know what you're talking about. Yes, he was in the CIA.
Wow.
No, he wasn't.
That's interesting. That's like a window into what people want to believe.
Yeah.
And why they want to believe that.
Yeah. Well, because
hey, Prince, run into him? Because
he was labeled by like Time Magazine as like, you know, the king of mean. And everybody had this thing about like, this guy just must be the worst human being on the face of the earth. When in fact, I dare to say that if you needed a kidney, he would have given you one.
Yeah.
He was the most generous guy. Whenever we'd have breaks, whether it was the Gong Show or the New Treasure Hunt or any of the other shows that I worked, Newlywed Game, Dating Game, he would have a feast of food for everybody. And he'd sit there and play his guitar and everybody would sing along and get along. And at the same time, if there was something important that was going on, Chuck would pull you aside and go, listen, this is a problem I'm having. Are we okay with it? We'll work this out. Good. Everybody wanted to please him.
Mm-hmm.
It was, like you said, the best boss in town.
He gave out awards. He made jackets. He incentivized people. He really wanted everyone to feel like this was their family.
And he went to bat for people.
Yeah. Like, talk about the time where someone from legal came up to him and said, you know, you've got to stop using the crew because now they're in two unions and, you know, and we don't want to have to pay for that. And
yeah. And the thing is, he just sort of essentially ignored that. Chuck wanted to do right by his crew. Chuck wanted his crew to be loyal to him, but he also recognized that you can't just tell somebody, be loyal to me. You have to give them a reason to want to keep coming back and keep coming back. And this was a guy who, he would rent out buses and take his crew out for Pink's hot dogs or take them out for a day at the movies, just as a fun thing to do, to give everyone a break from working. So Chuck was warned, listen, you know, we've got to please these... we can't really have anybody who's a member of two unions because now we're vulnerable to strikes from two people. And that's why they didn't want Gene the Dancing Machine on the show, is Gene is already a member of one union. But if you have him being a performer of two unions, then we're at risk for two strikes happening. We're vulnerable to two strikes happening. And Chuck just kind of ignored it. And what ended up happening was absolutely nothing. The network just kind of saw, well, he's still using Gene. The audience likes Gene. The show is doing well. There's really nothing we can do here. So gradually the rules just kind of went away and it just became, okay, yes, you can be a member of two unions. And that came from Chuck not caring.
So after he wrote the book, then they made a movie version of it. I think that's what Fritz was referencing.
Yeah. And Chuck, again, Chuck, and this was a thing that Chuck had a lot of trouble about, was the fact that his identity was so tied to the Gong Show. And Chuck sort of realized in hindsight he had done too much with the Gong Show, or I think that's the way he came to feel. That show became a hit to a degree that Chuck wasn't expecting. And I think the source of the breakdown was it got to a point where he was trying to top himself every single day. Now, the thing about game shows is you want people to stay interested. You want people to stay engaged. But a game show really is the same thing every single day. It's mm-hmm. the same game, and it's the same rules, and it's the same. Chuck really felt enormous pressure to top each successive episode of The Gong Show by doing something new or something vaguely offensive or doing something just really shocking and unexpected. And that's a real creative strain when you're doing five episodes a week.
It kind of reminds me of what happened to Andy Kaufman. If part of your act is shocking, mm-hmm. then people become numb to that level of shock and you've got to keep like ramping it up.
Yeah.
And so it's not sustainable. And to me, it feels like Gong Show had the run it was meant to have. Mm-hmm. But it did put all that pressure on Chuck to yeah. keep talking.
And it was different than a regular game show because they had to produce performances. Mm-hmm. A regular yeah. game show, yeah. you know, Pat yes, Sajak does yeah. five, six episodes a day yeah, and he's I mean, out. They have to stage performances, their sound, the lighting, and all the production of it.
It's like a mini variety show.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And it was exhausting and it was frustrating for him. And part of the shocking, part of the outrageous, part of the trying to top himself was Chuck did essentially turn himself into a character on that show. Eventually, he's not really wearing a tuxedo anymore. He's wearing a variety of costumes with strange hats, hockey jerseys, parade uniforms, military uniforms, and he's doing a wardrobe change for every act just for the fun of it. And he's also willing to make himself be the butt of the joke to the point that people thought he was an idiot. People thought he was a clown. People thought he was this doofus character that he was on TV. And Chuck even ended up making a movie towards the end of the run of the show, The Gong Show Movie, which is one of the less good movies ever made. but it was this movie written by Chuck, and it was basically Chuck making a screenplay out of things he almost certainly told his therapist privately. And there's just this monologue where he's talking about how tired he is of people thinking he's a clown. And I think just all that is what came to a head was he was tired of trying to top himself, and he was tired of the fact that he had this hit show that he created and everything was his idea, but then he looks back on it and realizes people think I'm an idiot because of this thing that I created and showed them. And that just became a very hard thing for him to take. And so by the time he's written Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, even though he's fabricated some of the story, you are getting a little sense of who he is. You get the sense that there's a lot going on. You get the sense that he's a little bit disturbed and a little bit frustrated and depressed, and it's not getting properly dealt with, and he needed an outlet to do that. And I think writing ended up being a real therapeutic thing for him. He left television essentially just to become a novelist. Mm-hmm. And none of his books were really runaway bestsellers, with the exception of Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, because of the curiosity surrounding it. But that's what Chuck did as kind of his second act in life. He left game shows and television production behind and just wrote novels. And I think that made him happy. I think that was something for him to channel his frustrations.
But, he had two of the great successes in game show history, which was Newlywed and Dating Game.
Yeah.
Let's talk about those two. I'm going to mention some names, and then I want you to answer a question I've had.
Okay.
So some of the people that showed up on the Dating Game were Arnold Schwarzenegger, Farrah Fawcett, John Ritter, Steve Martin,
mm-hmm.
wow, Michael Bolton, Sally Field, Lindsay Wagner, Suzanne Summers, and Andy Kaufman.
Yep.
So here's what I want to know. Did they all go on dates? And did they go alone? Because Sally Field, I can't imagine that she's going to let Bob pick her up at her house in a Buick at 8:30 and they're going to go on a date. How did those play out?
Do you want me to take part of that?
Yeah, go right ahead. Because this is somebody who actually can speak from experience.
I did two Dating Game episodes. And I was 17 for the first one, 18 for the second one. And when a woman was under the age of 21, it had to be a female chaperone for insurance purposes to go along. So I had a female, complete female stranger sleeping in my hotel room with me for the 7 days I was on my fabulous dream vacation.
7 days?
7 days, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Can you imagine that?
Yeah, no, it was... Well, the first trip was lovely because we went to San Diego. It was close by. The second one was in the Bahamas, and the guy pretty much dumped me when I was there.
Did you pick him or did he pick you?
I picked him.
Okay.
And he wasn't particularly interested in my gender.
Ah.
So he went off.
Understood.
and had his own experience, okay. And I was stuck with the grandma chaperone the mm-hmm. whole time.
You were the beard. I get it.
Oh, yeah.
Well, a lot of people went on that show just, I mean, a lot.
For the money, sometimes and, went on yeah. the publicity.
And they were after people, and it was a way to just practice yeah. being on TV.
But also, if I, for example, if I picked my bachelor and he did not want to go on the date with me, I was free to bring anybody along with me of the opposite sex. So I couldn't bring my mom with me or something like that. So several of my friends from high school, when they got their dream vacations, they took their own regular girlfriend or boyfriend with him on the trip.
Yeah,
that was the second part of my question. Do you have to go on the date? Could you say, I don't want to be outside this building with this human being? Or something?
And actually, the story that's become more and more popular in recent years, the serial killer who was a contestant on the Dating Game.
Really?
The woman that he made the date with went to Chuck Barris' staff after the show and said, I'm getting the worst vibes from him. Do I have to go on this date?
Wow.
And Chuck's staff told her, no, you don't have to go on this date. So she was able to potentially dodge a bullet in hindsight.
Was
but
it
no,
Ron Archola?
Rodney something.
Wow. Yeah.
So there was that. But also going back to the after fees, this was a brilliant little workaround Chuck had when he first started doing the show, because the first few episodes of the Dating Game were very, very boring. And the reason they were boring was because they were your average everyday people off the street. So what you had every day was Bachelor number one, what's your favorite sport? Football. Bachelor number two, what's your favorite sport? Football. Bachelor number three, what's your favorite sport? Football.
I'm narrowing it down.
Yeah.
I'm gonna go with number two.
Yeah. So Chuck Barris said, okay, this show is pretty boring. So they made two fixes. They Chuck recruited a guy that he had just hired named Mike Metzger to write more interesting questions for the show. So the questions now became, what piece of sporting equipment do you find sexiest? Which is an odd sounding question, and it's a little interesting, and it gets a laugh, and there's something to work with. But the other change made, and this is very, very rare and unusual for game shows, Chuck made it known that he would pay scale to anybody who is a member of the acting union. And the reason he did that was because he felt that the show needed some ringers. He needed people who had had acting training and who had some improv comedy training and could think quickly on their feet and had a good sense of what you could or couldn't say on television already mm-hmm. built into them mm-hmm. To be contestants on the show. And if you were a member of an acting union, you would get a fee for being on the show. So whether you got the date or not, people would agree to be on the Dating Game because they were going to get the rent paid that month. But also, if Chuck was particularly impressed by you, Chuck's logic was people didn't really notice the individual contestants day in and day out. So what he would tell people that really made a good impression on him was, we'll have you back on the show in about 6 weeks and we'll just have you be on here under another name. Because it didn't...
Well, also, my friend Janet Wood, who was a up-and-coming young actress, her agent said, "Let go on the show, it's good publicity for you." And the guy that she won was a guy that she had already dated in real life.
Oh,
and they just both had to keep it quiet that they knew each other and just smiled for the cameras and did their thing.
And when he comes... I remember as a kid, I was very, very focused on the moment they would come around the curtain and I would be looking for the expression on the person's face, whether or not they were pleased with how this person worked. Because as a kid, you're trying to figure out, like, what's attractive, what isn't attractive, like, you know. So that was always really interesting to me, was that, you know, they picked someone, they come out from behind the curtain. Does a girl go, ah, or is she like, oh my God, he's so cute?
I'll tell you the one show I thought where the host really made a difference, other than Chuck Barris, was the Newlywed Game. I thought Bob Eubanks handled that so well. He just had the right amount of sarcasm. He would let moments breathe a little bit. He would take a break and let the people just sort of ruminate in what they said. And I loved his reactions to stuff.
And he would be very delighted that you noticed that about his contribution to the show, because what he did was very, very subtle and really not even visible on camera. But he said early in the run of that show, he picked up on a psychological trick that really helped that show break through, which was if somebody gives an answer to a question and you say, all right, then they're done talking. But he said what he figured out very early on was if somebody gives an answer and I just stare at them for 3 or 4 seconds and I don't say a word, they'll feel obligated to expand on that.
Ah.
And he said that was his little trick, was he would just kind of sit there and stare at them after they had already given their answer. And they would volunteer way too much information as a result of just that little extra stare from him. And that was where a lot of the gold on that show came from, was Bob Eubanks mastering the art of the stare.
It was excellent.
I just spoke to him this morning, as a matter of fact.
I've
no kidding.
They did. I don't know if you were there, Adam, at the Pacific Pioneers of Broadcasting. Did the thing.
I was there. Yeah.
Yeah, we had Michael Berger on last week, and he was there, and he was excellent. But I thought that was a great presentation. But he was there, and it was so good to see him. He's doing pretty well. How old is he? He's got to be over 90, right?
He's.
I don't think he's 90.
Getting
yet.
There. I would say probably 84. 5-ish, 86.
But you know what? What did you guys speak about this
morning? Well, what we were talking about is May 30th and June 1st in Burbank, at the Burbank Marriott, they're having the Quiz Show Expo, which is going to be like a Comic-Con for game show nerds.
So what happens there? You get to go there and get your Bob Eubanks tattoo autograph?
Yeah, he'll write on you, and yeah.
We are going to have game show legends signing autographs there. We're also going to have a live concert by The Remotes, which is an area band that specializes in themes from TV shows. And they'll be doing a concert of game show themes, and we're also going to be doing kind of the ultimate quiz show for game show fans. It's going to be all game show related trivia.
And Adam, who's writing those questions?
I am.
That's another thing. You've had a fascinating career.
Yeah.
You research trivia and you write questions. So what shows did you research trivia for?
I researched trivia for the shows that I've worked on in that capacity. Tic-Tac-Doe, we just finished a season of that for Game Show Network. Another new series for Game Show Network called Beat the Bridge. Masterminds, I did for 5 seasons for Game Show Network. Double Dare.
Idiot Test
I did graphics for. Mental Samurai for the Fox Network. So it's a pretty fun job, and it's one that people don't really think about. If you ask what a question researcher is, the way I explain it to people, because my roommate told me that she explains it to people like this, if you're ever watching a game show and a contestant gives an iffy answer and the host says, I need to check with our judges on this, that's me. I'm judges. And the process is we spend about, depending on the show, 8 to 11 weeks of pre-production. The writers prepare all these questions, and then my job is to go through all these questions and nitpick and nitpick and nitpick them. Is there some way that the question is phrased? Is there some word that makes it susceptible to this also being a correct answer? Are there other answers that are technically correct with the way the question is phrased right now? And it may be as simple as just looking up an entry in encyclopedia to verify it, or sometimes you have to make phone calls. I've had to make phone calls to an accordion museum to verify information for one question. I had to make a phone call to the agency that prints Russia's currency to verify another question. So, yeah, it's every day is a little bit different with this job.
But to start, can you just use trivia books? There are a zillion trivia books out there.
There are a zillion trivia books. Ideally, you don't use those because you don't know where they're getting their information from.
Let me step in with that, because I write game show questions for a living. Game shows are not all the same. So to just pick a question out of a trivia book, you might use that as a bit of a stepping off point to write a question. But for example, in the case of Jeopardy, you're not writing the question, you're writing the answer. And you're limited to a certain amount of characters that'll fit on the board at any given time. And you want to make the question entertaining. You want to make somebody put down their fork while they're eating so they can hear what the right question or answer is going to be. So as you're watching game shows, you'll realize that there's a style to each of these game shows and how the questions are written. So as much as I would like to take a Writers Guild salary for opening up a trivia book, you can't do that. It would just be dull. So I will defend that. And I'm sure there's times that there's questions. Like, I'll give you an example of the type of work that Adam does. I was working on a show once where the question was, what came first? And there was a list of four objects. And the answer they were trying to get was the Post-it note. So somebody like Adam would have to research that. And what they found out going, well, Post-it note was on the market at a certain time. But before that, it was only available for businesses to use. And it was under a different name, but it was still the same concept and blah, 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 blah. So you can't take anything for granted. So what seems like the simplest question becomes really complex at times.
We had a question once that I had to research. It was, which of these New York landmarks was built most recently? And it was a multiple choice question, and the correct answer we were going for was Madison Square Garden. But what I pointed out is, if you know your history of New York, the Madison Square Garden that's there now is the third one. So there is an argument to be made that, no, Madison Square Garden is not the one that opened the most recently, because these other two came along earlier.
You have to know a lot about a bunch of things.
Yeah. Quite a bit. And you do have to dig in. And what's great about it, kind of the accidental reward, is you end up learning extra tidbits while you're fact-checking the one thing that you were looking for. I want to tell you my favorite thing that I've ever learned from researching a question for a game show. Somebody had written a very simple question about the Wright brothers' flight at Kitty Hawk, which every one of us heard in elementary school history class. And while I was reading up on the material, just for the sake of saying, okay, I read something that confirms that they did this at Kitty Hawk, I stumbled on this fun fact about the Wright brothers that I have never heard. The Wright brothers published a newspaper for the black community in Dayton, Ohio. And the reason they did that was because it's hard to imagine this in the late 1800s, but they went to an integrated school. And one of Wilbur or Orville's, I think it was Orville's, one of Orville's classmates was an aspiring writer. And he was black, and he explained to Orville that this mindset even existed in the 1800s. He said he had a lot of trouble dealing with his desire to be a writer because he could get published through something for a white company, a white business. But he would feel like he was compromising his principles or his identity if he got published through a white company. And so Wilbur and Orville said, okay, well, what if we just start a newspaper that can be your newspaper, and that way you can be the writer and you can be in charge of hiring the staff, and that it'll just be your newspaper.
Why are we just hearing that for the first? That's a wonderful story.
So Wilbur and Orville started this newspaper called The Tattler in Dayton, Ohio, and the whole purpose of it was to fully staff it with black writers so all these folks could get experience in a forum that was for them.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
Never heard that before. That's amazing.
Do you know why ladybugs are called ladybugs?
Because they no.
There was an infestation of ladybugs that was absolutely destroying the crops somewhere in I believe Mexico, and so a lot of the farmers began saying prayers to the Virgin Mary to send something to get rid of these destructive insects that were eating all the crops. And in those days, the Virgin Mary was commonly depicted wearing black and red. So after they had said all these prayers to the Virgin Mary, this swarm of black and red insects shows up and starts eating the destructive insects while also not touching the plants. And the farmers started calling them the Beetles of Our Lady, and that became ladybugs.
Wow. That's a wonderful story. I guess I always thought it was because they were cute. They were cuter than regular bugs. You were happy to see one instead of get that mosquito away from my face.
Now, back in the 50s and 60s, the $64,000 question,
they
had this game show scandals, which really tightened up the regulation around games. So do you have to get your research, for instance, your questions or your trivia, perused by somebody in management to make sure they're all in the up and up?
Not necessarily the way that you're describing. There is some oversight. The producers will look at it and they'll send a question back to me and say, Adam, are you sure that this is right or this is wrong? And we'll have a conversation about what to do if a contestant does this right or wrong. But among the safeguards that we take now, first of all, I hate to break this to anybody who knows me, but if you know me, you're not getting on a game show. And I'll even say that a show that I worked on that I mentioned on earlier, Masterminds, I swear it felt like every taping we had of that show, we had to send somebody home because it was somebody I had crossed paths with. Oh, so wow. I've just ruined everything for everybody who's ever met me.
So when they get somebody on the show, you have to sign off on each person to make sure you don't have a pre-existing relationship with them?
Not necessarily sign off, but if I do realize that I recognize somebody, I'm obligated to let somebody know. Now, depending on who you know on the staff and what information you have access to, it's not a total killer for you to know somebody who works on the show. Like, for a member of the technical crew knew a contestant, but the members of the technical crew don't have access to the game information, so you couldn't help your friend cheat even if you wanted to. So it was fine for that person to be a contestant on the show.
I have a game show question for you guys.
Yeah.
Was I or was I not on a game show?
I have to recuse myself on that question.
Because you've looked at that picture right there of me and Frank going for the buzzer.
Woohoo!
What game show was that?
That is Face the Music.
Wow.
It was my first showbiz experience. I'm someone who can name tunes. And so even as like a 22-year-old, I went in and, you know, there's, as you know how they whittle it down, there's a room full of people and they're just playing songs.
Yeah.
And you have a long list and you just have to fill it in. And then they get you down to like four people. And then they want to see if you have a nice personality, which is, I'm sure, how you got on the dating game. So I made it on. Do you remember this show? I know you're a game show expert.
Absolutely. Yeah, because I grew up with Face the Music.
Yeah.
I was one of the obsessies that watched the afternoon block of reruns on Family Channel and USA Network. So I love Face the Music.
If you can find my episode,
okay.
I would love it because my aunt, she hit play and record, you know, halfway through.
Yeah.
So I have the second half.
Did you make it to the final round?
Yeah.
Who was your mystery face?
It was Katharine Hepburn.
Okay.
Do you want to hear what happened?
Sure.
So the guy that I beat this guy, Frank. Nice looking guy. But I beat him, and I'm going up against yesterday's champion who had won 8 days in a row. And this guy was confident. You know, he was just nailing it. I had bought these baby picture books to study, because in Face the Music in the last round, you had to identify a baby picture. You had to figure out which celebrity this was. So I bought these books and I studied, and then they would play a song, Tommy Oliver and the orchestra. Like, I'm the contestant that remembers every detail. I'm that person. Go ahead and ask me. You don't have to ask. I'm telling you the story. Okay. So Tommy Oliver is playing the songs, and it's like none of us know. Me and this guy, I can't remember his name, who won every week in a row. He and I both didn't know it, and they said it was the theme from Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, you know? And we're both like, okay. And then, or it was the theme from An Affair to another movie with Katharine Hepburn in it. So by the time they got to the next one, we both know it's going to be Katharine Hepburn, right? Because they've said two Katharine Hepburn movies. And it was, I've grown accustomed to her face. And it was a matter of who got to the button faster. Because, you know, when they play a theme from two Katharine Hepburn movies that are unrecognizable, but we know it's Katharine Hepburn in these both of these movies, we both at this point know it's Katharine Hepburn. And he just got to the... That's how I remember it. And so I won luggage and a trip to Palm Springs.
That a girl?
Yeah.
Nice.
How come I've never heard this about you before?
I should have told you this.
You bury your light under a basket. What are you saying?
But see,
so I'm going to talk.
There's me and Frank.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. I'll look closer at that picture. I can't see it from here.
You know, also, in talking about doing the research that Adam does, a lot of times people will just think, oh, I'll just go to Wikipedia and I'll just write down whatever they say. But, you know.
No, it's wrong.
You have to have certain verifiable, reliable sources, and the network will sometimes provide those to you of what you could use. And Adam's been at this so long that I think he's got a good BS detector on a lot of these questions that come through. So usually you can't just go to like even the New York Times and say, "Oh, well, the New York Times said, you know, Abraham Lincoln was the 16th president." You know, you got to find another source that's independent of that.
Mm-hmm. So you call the librarian.
But a lot of times, too, if you look in a publication, like the New York Times says Abraham Lincoln was the 16th president, where was their source? So you have to find another source from them.
Right, so the earth really is flat.
Yeah. Let me tell you my two game show debacle experiences.
Ooh, I want to hear your game
Because there's so few people that give a crap about this, I'm going to tell you about it.
No, we all do.
So when Wheel of Fortune, you know, Pat Sajak, of course, was the weatherman at Channel 4 before I got there. Was doing Wheel, and then they were going to have a syndicated version and a nighttime version. So they were auditioning hosts for the syndicated version. So I went down the hall and auditioned. And the director of the show was Johnny Carson's brother.
Dick
Carson. I'm sure you knew him. So I don't watch the game, which is always a really bad thing.
That's how come you didn't know that I was on Face the Music with Ron Ely, TV's Tarzan.
But even games that I audition for, I don't watch. So I fake my way through it, and all of my stand-up comedy defense mechanisms kicked in. So whenever there was a dull moment, I felt it was necessary to make a stupid joke. So I'm filling all the space. And I thought, you know what? I just killed this. I'm going to get this job. So I went back to the stage, and Dick Carson, with this grave look on his face, said, you know, we're not going to give you the job, and I'll tell you why. He said, when you're hosting a game show, the star is the game, not you. And I thought, why couldn't you tell me that before I came out here and made a fool out of myself? But he's so right. Yeah. All the best guys allow the show to shine. I mean, Pat Sajak could do a snarky joke every 30 seconds and get away with it. But no, the game is the show. Now, here's my second one, and then I'll leave you alone. Are you okay?
I think I have time. Okay. Yeah. But listen, do you have your audition tape? I'd be curious to see your audition tape.
I don't think they wanted to waste videotape on that.
I won't name a name, but I will say I've seen the audition tape of somebody else that was in consideration for that time.
Rolf Benerska.
Not him.
That's
not,
who got
the,
it.
The guy who got the
That's
job.
Who got it because Merv had a crush on him.
But I've seen, without naming a name, I've seen the audition tape for one of the other people who auditioned for the job that went to Rolf Benerska. And the audition tape I've seen, the gentleman spins the wheel the wrong way.
Ooh, that's...
and that's so great. Sin number one, but also...
I never got to the wheel.
But also, the part where the contestant spins the wheel and you call out the amount that their arrow has landed on. He didn't get that right. So, like, you'd see the wheel come to a stop on $300 and he'd say, hey, $850. And it's no.
I would look at the space
in front of you. Look at the space in front of the contestants.
Ooh,
I would pay you to find my audition tape, and then I would destroy it. It's like a catch and kill situation.
I
want to
see it. Catch and kill these auditions.
But I want to tell you my other one, and I'm just asking for your patience with this because nobody else in the world, my even children don't even care about this, so I'll just tell you because you're in the business.
We are wrapped.
So I auditioned and got the show to take Bill Cullen's place on a show called Hot Potato.
Wow.
It was Barry Enright, right?
Yeah.
I got the show. I was passed. I got to the point where I had an outfit picked out. They had the set built. And I thought at that time, maybe I better go ask my boss if it's okay for me to host a game show external of the weather. And I went in there and asked him. He said, no, you're not hosting a game show. Because what happened was, when Pat Sajak was doing the weather and wheel at the same time, they felt like his attention was being stretched too thin. So they went to him and said, Pat, we think you're not giving enough of your heart and soul to the weather, and you're tired, you're traveling, you're doing the show. We want you to make up your mind which one of these shows you would like to stick with. Thinking he's going to say the weather, because the news is the show that never gets canceled. If he's smart, he's going to take the weather, right? So he said, okay, I'm doing Wheel of Fortune. And so they got burned really badly. And so my boss said to me, I will never let that happen to me again. No, you're not doing the game show. And Barry Enright almost sued my boss. I had to talk my way out of that. It was awful. And it's my own fault. I should have asked him back when I was auditioning, but I didn't.
Wow.
No, sometimes you do it first and then ask permission.
So I, as a game show fan and as a biographer, my first biography was Bill Cullen. So first of all, that makes my day.
Yeah.
I'm wearing his jewelry right now.
Yeah. Wow.
The family gave it to me. I want to make it clear that, you know, this wasn't, I didn't sneak in at the funeral or anything like that, but this was a gift from the family. But yeah, Bill Cullen was my guy. So I'm always looking out for stories about him. But
who's the best of all time in your
I would say Bill.
Yeah, Bill.
Bill and Dennis James gets an honorable mention because Dennis James was the first real game show host. So he was kind of the one who established the template for the job. So I would say those two.
I have two other names.
Gene Rayburn is pretty twinkly.
Peter Marshall.
Yeah. What a lovely man. And I'll say the other one, Dick Clark.
Yeah, Dick Clark's
now,
a great
guy. He's the guy that does the Ryan Seacrest School of Broadcasting. Just don't be offensive to one other human being on the planet.
Yeah, he doesn't get in the way of the game.
No.
And see, that's the thing. I hear these knocks against Ryan Seacrest, and I kind of don't get it.
I like Ryan Seacrest.
Ryan is...
Ryan is smart.
Ryan is classical.
He is really smart.
Broadcaster.
I think he's funny,
he
too.
Really is.
Yeah. I did the weather on his radio show for many years when he was at 98.7.
Yeah. No, he is exactly Dick Clark. And so, I mean, I think Wheel of Fortune made a great call going with him, and I think it's going to be good for the show.
But I want to hear Shelley's Betty White story
yes.
before we get off track.
Oh,
yes.
You know what? I'd like to say it's my Betty White story, but it's...
Let's hear
our yeah. Betty White story.
Because yeah. you can't talk about game shows without a Betty White story.
Yeah. So some years ago, I got this idea that I was going to write a book about Alan Ludden, Betty White's husband.
Love him.
And the reason that I thought Alan Ludden was an interesting subject for a book is not just the fact that I'm a game show lover and he had hosted Password, which was a legendary show, but also I kind of found the Betty White story interesting in the sense that she and Alan Ludden went together for 20 years. Everybody knew that they were an item, and you'd always see them in the press as Alan Ludden and Betty White, Betty White and Alan Ludden. They mm-hmm. were together, and the general public associated with them. Everybody knew this couple in Hollywood, Betty White and yeah. Alan Ludden. And then Alan Ludden dies, and Betty White becomes an even bigger star after Alan Ludden died because of the Golden Girls and because of the new generation of fans that show created for her.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was this very strange thing where Alan becomes a trivia tidbit. Did you know that Betty White was married to a game show host before? So
yeah.
it was something like that. So I wanted to do something that shined a light on him. And so I sent a note to an address that I thought would get it to Betty White saying, hey, I'd like to write a book about your husband. Would you be okay with me doing that? And never got a response. So I ended up writing this book without any involvement of Betty White or her children or anybody else in her family. But I wrote this book about Alan Ludden. And... again, once the book was published, I thought, okay, well, I'll send it off and maybe someday it'll land on her lap. But I sent it off to this address that I thought might end up putting it in front of Betty White. Never heard anything. And then Betty White passed away a few years ago. And a few weeks later, her personal assistant uploads what she says is the last photo ever taken of Betty White. It was like the day before she died. And it's Betty sitting at her coffee table, and sitting in front of Betty White is my book
no.
with multiple bookmarks in it. And
Stop.
A cover. The cover is visibly worn on it.
You killed oh. Betty White.
No. No, so, it was obviously very, very loved.
She yeah. was getting prepared to meet him
yeah.
again.
Well,
and,
making sure that they shared, you know, that if they went on the Newlywood Game, that
yeah.
their
wow.
questions
and she thought she should brush up. Yeah.
Brush
what
up.
Was the special quality of him? He seemed like a guy that played it way back.
Well, before we do, Alan, let's.
But yeah,
oh, I'm sorry.
They did this estate sale with Betty White's.
Well, this is where I joined the story.
Yeah, and
he puts the picture on Facebook, which all of us were just sobbing when we just saw how meaningful this was to Adam, as well as how meaningful it had been to Betty.
Yeah.
So both Adam and I are involved with a museum that exists in Rochester, New York, the Strong Museum of Play.
Mm-hmm.
And they're opening up a special area in 2026 that's just going to house game show memorabilia. So I call Betty's assistant. Hi, you don't know me, but I knew Betty from when I worked on the Liars Club. And when you go through her things, I know you'll have an estate sale. You'll probably come across game show stuff and you'll throw it away because you're going to think, who wants this stuff?
Mm,
we do.
We do, yeah.
So her assistant put together an inventory list of all the items that they would like to donate. And papers from Alan, things of Betty's. An Emmy of Betty's that they donated to the museum.
Wow.
And the very last thing at the bottom is she says, would your friend Adam like his book back from Betty?
Oh, really?
So I said yes, and I sent the message back basically asking, do not touch any of the bookmarks. I kind of want to see what
yes,
she marked.
Yes, of course.
And it turned out she had multiple books. Basically, she had marked every photo of herself and Alan in the
really?
Book. Yeah.
Aww.
So... those were the bookmarks. And
you've had
so,
an amazing career.
Yeah.
Talk about the other books you've written.
I started writing books in 2012. I've written Quizmaster, The Life and Times and Fun and Games of Bill Cullen. There's a second edition of that coming because Bill did so much stuff in his career that we keep finding new information about stuff that he did that we didn't know about. So mm-hmm. there's a second edition of that on the way. Okay, Dennis James, Lifetime of First, The Matchless Gene Rayburn. It's More Than Password, The Life and Wife of Alan Ludden. Again, as you said, a fantastic title. Thank you to Chris Lambert for that. Gong This Book is the new one. This Day in Game Show History, which is a four-volume set, and Game Show's FAQ.
Four-volume set.
Is yeah. there a huge game show enthusiasm subculture. I mean, are you going to have lines out the door in Burbank? I'm going to go to that thing. That sounds fascinating to me.
Talk to me.
What's the day? What's the date again?
It is May 30th and June 1st.
31st.
Yeah. May 30th for Friday and a Saturday at the Burbank Marriott. If you go to quizshowexpo.com, you can arrange to get tickets. And if you're from out of town listening to this, they have special hotel blocks of rooms set aside for people.
That sounds fascinating.
I'm going to have my own booth as someone that was on Face the Music.
Bring those pictures along, too.
Lining up now because there's going to be a rush.
That's gold. Yeah.
All right. Pictures. So here's my final question. Did the kids who watch The Gong Show grow up to create reality TV?
You know, the thing is, The Gong Show was always kind of there, and I touch on this in the book. It was a little funny that Chuck got the blame for this show is causing the end of Western civilization, because something like The Gong Show has always existed from the beginning of show business. In the 1930s, you had Major Bowes' Amateur Hour, mm-hmm. which was very much the same thing, right down to banging the gong for an act that wasn't performing well.
Oh, wow.
And then prior to that, it was the amateur nights on vaudeville, where you had people getting the hook on the neck when they weren't performing well.
The Apollo Theater.
Yeah, mm-hmm. This is just something that's always existed. So it's the natural extension. We've gone from The Gong Show to America's Got Talent, which is the same idea. It's wacky, weird acts and a celebrity panel, and it's not a gong, but they are making a noise to interrupt an act that they aren't impressed with. It's just an idea that's been there for all time, and it's an idea that just works, and people gravitate towards it. People are curious. It satisfies the inner performer in somebody to see somebody else actually having the guts to do it.
Living the
on
dream,
stage.
Absolutely.
Living the dream,
people
yeah.
People empathize with.
But you know what? Other people have tried to do The Gong Show,
mm-hmm.
but Chuck had the secret sauce for
yeah.
it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Because the yeah. secret sauce was himself. That's the thing that keeps coming up is people say, I've been posting videos of The Gong Show on my Facebook page to promote this. Although to note, they are the property of Sony and no challenge to copyright is intended. But I've been posting these videos on my website, and what people keep saying is, oh, I want to see The Gong Show again. I want to see The Gong Show again. First of all, it was on the air 5 years ago, so you didn't watch it. But what keeps happening is that flavor is missing, because what nobody is noticing is that when you're nostalgic for The Gong Show, what you're nostalgic for is Chuck. Chuck was the identity of that show. It was his spirit. It was his ideas for how to present the act. It was his presentation. It was his method of performing. That was so much of the show that if you do it, you've got a talent show, but it's not The Gong Show. And whatever you do in the future, no matter what you call it, it can't be The Gong Show, because we've lost Chuck.
But is it streaming anywhere now?
It's not. And the complication here is music rights. Music licensing, the deals they made over the years have expired. And so if anybody wants to stream the show or put it on a DVD set or something like that, they're going to have to negotiate the music licensing rights all over again. So unfortunately, it's not out there publicly as any sort of official release. But
well, we don't have the recipe for The Gong Show without Chuck. But we do have is this idea that anybody could be on a show,
yeah,
or that anybody's life is interesting enough to just start filming, and they would make an interesting show, that regular folks mm-hmm. can become famous. So you know, you have everything from Angelina taking out billboards to the Kardashians to what have you. Mm-hmm. And I think Chuck sort of opened the door to just sort of, it felt like maybe if everyone who moved to Los Angeles in the 70s to become a star just kind of went through your TV for half an hour.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's what you, a cross section of like whoever's trying to make it or thinking that they could come up with something goofy enough, you know, because obviously we knew that people had concocted, I'm going to hang upside down and light me on fire and I'll play the banjo. Like, obviously, that's not something they did at home.
And, you know, it's in a way, it's a forerunner to what we ended up using social media for, because we're just talking about wanting to
yeah.
do something goofy to get attention.
TikTok.
And that's so mm-hmm. much of TikTok, and that's so much of Instagram. And it's the same basic idea. Do something goofy to attract people's attention and make your name for yourself as the guy who does the goofy thing. And so we've gone from The Gong Show to people just being able to do it over their phones. And if anything, TikTok or Instagram, just streaming, just going through the reels on that, you can stitch together a variety show just looking at the different videos on there.
That is an excellent point.
What's your next book? Bill Cullen number two?
Is that what we're Bill Cullen, yeah. The second edition of the Bill Cullen biography is on the way shortly, with a lot of new information and a lot of new photos
he
from Bill's family.
Turns out to be a spy.
Yeah. Yeah, what's funny is it's I've got vacation photos from his family now, and they've got this trip to Italy, and Bill, God bless him, just in case a game show broke out wherever he was, Bill always wore a suit, even on vacation. And there's this really funny photo of him on vacation in Italy, and the only reason it's funny is because he's wearing a black suit and a black necktie and sunglasses while he's on vacation in Italy, and looks 100% like he's there on a job from the CIA. He really does.
But one interesting fact about Bill Cullen that I always kind of knew as a child, because my father had suffered from polio and was in a wheelchair. And I had always heard as a child, so tell me if I have this correct, that Bill Cullen also had suffered from polio, walked with a limp, and no one really ever knew that. It's sort of like FDR, no one really ever knew that about him.
Bill walked with a limp, and despite the shortcomings of polio, just his talent for the job and his ability to host a show well and bring out the personality of his contestants and engage with them and engage with the viewing audience, that was enough to overcome it. And so you have this extraordinary guy who hosted over 40 game shows on radio and television. And there was a period in 1973 and then another period in 1976 where he was on 22 times a week on all three networks plus syndication with different game shows. And
they
he
wouldn't
was
do
going
that
to,
now. Exclusivity clauses.
Yeah, and he did that by just being good at what he did, despite the fact that he was disabled.
He's a slow burn.
Yeah.
And don't you have a special website dedicated to Bill Cullen?
Yes, BillCullen.net. A friend of mine, Matt Ottinger, a fellow Cullenologist, and I maintain a website to Bill's life. And we're kind of tripping over ourselves because the Film and Television Archive at UCLA just unearthed what they call the oldest existing video of an entertainment program, Milton Berle's Kraft Music Hall, from October 9th, 1958.
Stop.
And
really?
It's now on YouTube, but the great thing about it was they hit the record button early when they began doing it that night. So the first minute and a half of the show is Bill signing off from The Price is Right, and it's the first color footage from that run of the show.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's so cool. Bill,
and also, if you want to know a little bit more about Adam, and I'm gonna tattle on you for this. Online, there's a segment of when Conan O'Brien visited Madame Tussauds Wax Museum in Hollywood, mm-hmm. and Adam was the tour guide for Conan.
And that's my origin story. Yeah. I got the call from two people in management the night before, just pulling me aside and saying, hey, Adam, we need you to be a representative of the company tomorrow. We need you to speak on behalf of the company and do something where television cameras are going to be present. Are you going to be comfortable representing the company in front of television cameras? And Madame Tussauds does a lot of publicity events where it's like a celebrity poses side by side with their wax figure. And so I'm thinking it's something like that. And I said, yeah, I'm willing to do that. What's the idea? And they said, you're going to be on Conan. And okay, so with very, very little notice, I was on the show as Conan's tour guide in the Wax Museum, and that got me 15 minutes of fame because I did a really odd thing that I had done for a long time as an icebreaker at parties, which was if you gave me your date of birth, I could tell you the game shows that aired on the day you were born.
Wow.
And I haven't done that in years because now it's a lot easier to tell people I've written 11 books about the history of game shows, and that gets the point across that I like game shows a lot more.
Yeah.
But yeah, I got 15 minutes of fame for that. I would say for about 6 months after that, people were coming to the museum to get their photo taken with me, which was
really?
Wow,
that's funny. That's so cool.
And this is now on YouTube, and if you go through comments, you can see all kinds of comments from people eager to diagnose me. And but yeah, that was the start of it. Conan was so blown away when I did this trick that he spent about 20 minutes chatting me up just about game shows, and none of that ended up airing.
He's obsessed with them too.
Not really, but like it was just like he was looking for something to mine for comedy for this thing. And as it turned out, there was nothing that hilarious about my obsession with game shows, it turned out, but he spent about 20 minutes talking to me about it. And in the course of that, and I've told this story so many times, but in the course of talking to him about game shows, I said out loud, I'd like to write a book about game shows someday. And the thing about that is, I'd like to write a book someday is the mating call of guys with no sense of direction in their lives. So,
also, once you say it out loud, then you've committed to it.
Especially in front of a camera. So I was like, okay, I said it out loud. I said it where people could hear me. I said it with a camera rolling. I have to write books now.
Words are things.
Yeah.
And you know what I want to say about game shows, and a lot of people listening to this podcast will, if they think about it, will probably agree with me, is that as a child, you watch a lot of cartoons and you watch a lot of shows with kids in them and you watch a lot of sitcoms. But when you watch game shows, you're watching adults behave in a way that they think is interesting and amusing. And it's sort of instructive in terms of what's going to be expected of you as an interesting adult. And I would watch To Tell the Truth. And so you'd see really like New York sophisticates, you know, like Kitty Carlisle and Orson Bean and like, oh, wow, I don't know most of what they're referencing, but I would love to be able to
looking
sit
down
with...
their nose at you.
Yeah, but like the idea that like I one day maybe I would be smart enough to sit and have a conversation with Orson Bean. You know, it kind of, I think it's good for kids to see what adults think is silly, what they think is interesting, what they think is funny. And the Match Game did that as well because a lot of their answers were just sort of bawdy and naughty and like, ooh, you know. And so you learn a little bit about sex and, you know, just everything adults are supposed to know if they're going to be good company.
Oh, yeah. It was certainly my frame of reference. I admire the host a lot. And if my mother was here with us right now, the first thing she would make it a point to tell you to is that I walked around in suits when I was five because I wanted to.
No!
I felt that was part of the package. It's not enough to act like an adult. You have to wear a suit because adults wear suits. That's what I learned from Game
Dina Harris. Has something. Yeah.
I just wanted to share something really quick because, you know, growing up, obviously now it's a different media landscape, but I have an experience as an immigrant to this country. So growing up at a time when it before social media, game show and before reality TV, game shows were a way for me as someone who was like not neither myself nor any of my family members were native to this country. It was a way to kind of see what like social norms were, like what like kind of. You know, going off your point, Weezy, of like
and the humor.
Yeah, exactly. It's like how, you know, kind of helps you like figure out how to integrate into like, you know, your new culture.
What did you gravitate
toward? The
first thing
she learned how to stay was, we'll be right back after this message.
Well, you know, Mila Kunis has talked about how when she came to this country, she learned English by watching The Price is Right because she said Bob Barker was the only person on TV who spoke slowly enough that she could understand every individual word.
What show did you like? What did you like?
I mean, I fancy myself a poor man's Mila Kunis, so I do enjoy The Price is Right, and I. You know, I loved like Jeopardy and like Wheel of Fortune, like those kind of shows because you kind of, for different reasons, right? Because Jeopardy was a way like to gain knowledge.
Oh, yeah.
And Wheel of Fortune was like this kind of cross section of, you know, the contestants really represented. Like,
or learning English just by spelling.
I had an Uber driver once who told me this story. He had emigrated to the United States from Russia in the 1980s. And it was when Wheel of Fortune was on twice a day. And he said when he first came to this country, he made it a point to watch Wheel of Fortune twice a day because just the repetition, the repetitive nature of the game, he learned what each letter of the alphabet was. He learned the sound that each one made. And seeing incomplete words come into formation on the game board taught
Pretty
him
cool.
what different combinations of letters sounded
we
like.
We had the creators of the New Zoo Review on here a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
They had a very touching story about a kid in Mexico that learned English by watching that show on American television. Yeah. And you just never know how it's affecting the
But if
general
a hippopotamus
public.
Can speak English, so can I. So thank you guys so much for being here. Any shout-outs that you want to do before we read the credits? Shelley's book is called My Peacock Tale, and if you haven't read that, read that. It's such a great book.
Thank you. And if people want to see a little bit about it, mypeacocktale.com. And Adam?
Gong This Book is now available pretty much wherever books are sold. Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com, ThriftBooks.com has it in stock. It's now available in its third printing because the first two came out blurry.
Wow. That's like some crazy Chuck Barris from Beyond joke. Okay, here come your credits. Thanks for coming down. Thanks for coming along down the media path. We would love to continue this conversation with you on Instagram and Twitter, where we are at Media Path Pod, and on Facebook, where our show page is Media Path Podcast, and our Facebook group is Media Path with Fritz and Wheezy Podcast Community. And we are a video podcast on YouTube. You get to watch us and laugh at our outfits, and then hopefully you'll subscribe. Our YouTubes are full of additional visual treats that will surprise and delight you. Find us at MediaPath Podcast on YouTube. Write to us at MediaPathPodcast@gmail.com. Tell us what you've been watching, reading, and loving. If you enjoy our show, please give us a nice rating wherever you get your podcasts and share our social media posts so that your friends can learn about your excellent taste in podcasts. Our website is MediaPathPodcast.com. Here, you can find interesting episodes you may have missed. We also have a fun and sassy newsletter loaded with bonus content about our guests. All of the newsletters are right there for you to enjoy on our website, and you can sign up to get your newsletter sent directly into your inbox. Just one per week. We do understand healthy boundaries. We want to thank our guests, Adam Neidiff and Shelley Herman. Our team includes producer Dina Friedman, John Maddox, Bill Filipiak, Mason Brown, Garrett Arch, Jordan Reyes, and you. Our theme music is by me and John Maddox. I am Louise Planker, here with Fritz Coleman and Shelley Herman and Adam Neidiff. Be well and wise and be kind to one another, and we will see you along the media path.